Welcome to the Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles, and this week we'll boldly go where the Book Report has not gone before. We're going into the lab to examine books about science and medicine. If you're a regular Book Report listener, you know your humble guide is the total liberal arts girl. In college, science gave me the sweats, but the category is so rich, so riveting, and the titles I've chosen are so very accessible, we're going to explore. So stay tuned and you'll be hooked as I was. Let's turn now to page one of the Book Report.
Traditional advertising can be expensive and wasteful. But lately, you've been hearing a lot about social media and viral marketing. But let's be honest, it's confusing. That's why you need Magic Buzz, a new marketing company so unique, we've even coined a special phrase for what we do. Socio-viral. We combine the word-of-mouth friendliness of social media, like Facebook, Twitter, together with the viral reach power of YouTube, to create the socio-viral effect. The Magic Buzz team makes sure our clients are well represented online. We recently took word-of-mouth advertising to the number one position as most productive medium for a major cell phone company. That's right. Magic Buzz produced more sales than an expensive TV campaign at a fraction of the cost. Put the power of socio-viral marketing to work for you. Visit us at magicbuzz.com. M-A-G-I-C-B-U-Z.com. If you have any questions, please feel free to email us at info@magicbuzz.com. Magic Buzz. We're there when you can't be.
When MIT physicist Walter Lewin's lectures were made available online, he became an instant YouTube celebrity. The New York Times declared, "Walter Lewin delivers his lectures with the panache of Julia Child bringing French cooking to amateurs." For more than 30 years as a beloved prof at MIT, Lewin honed his craft of making physics accessible and truly fun. As Carl Sagan did for astronomy, Lewin takes listeners on a marvelous journey in For the Love of Physics, From the End of the Rainbow to the Edge of Time, a journey through the wonders of physics. The book reveals the hidden workings of the world all around us. Are we shorter standing up than lying down? Why are the colors of a rainbow always in the same order? And would it be possible to put our hand out and touch one? Why does the air smell so fresh after a lightning storm? Why do we briefly lose and gain weight when we ride in an elevator? Lewin, with co-author Warren Goldstein, never ceases to surprise and delight in spotlighting the extraordinary ability of physics to answer the most elusive questions. Kent Casella narrates.
Saeed, an Iranian who had already earned a couple of American master's degrees, writes, "I never really enjoy of life until I have watched you teach physics. Professor Lewin, you have changed my life indeed. The way you teach, it is worth 10 times the tuition and makes some, not all other teachers, bunch of criminals. It is capital crime to teach bad." Or Siddharth from India, "I could feel physics beyond those equations." Your students will always remember you as I always remember you, as a very, very fine teacher who made life and learning more interesting than I thought was possible. Mohammed enthusiastically quotes Lewin's final lecture in Physics 8.01 with approval. "Perhaps you will always remember from my lectures that physics can be very exciting and beautiful, and it's everywhere around us, all the time, if only you have learned to see it and appreciate its beauty." Marjorie, another fan, wrote, "I watch you as often as I can, sometimes 5 times per week. I am fascinated by your personality, your sense of humor, and above all, your ability to simplify matters. I hated physics in high school, but you made me love it." Lewin receives dozens of such emails every week, and he answers each one. Walter Lewin creates magic when he introduces the wonders of physics. What's his secret? "I introduce people to their own world," he says, "the world they live in and are familiar with, but don't approach like a physicist yet. If I talk about waves on water, I ask them to do certain experiments in their bathtubs. They can relate to that. They can relate to rainbows. That's one of the things I love about physics. You get to explain anything. And that can be a wonderful experience for them and for me. I make them love physics. Sometimes when my students get really engaged, the classes almost feel like happenings. He might be perched at the top of a 16-foot ladder sucking cranberry juice out of a beaker on the floor with a long, snaking straw made out of lab tubing. Or he could be courting serious injury by putting his head in the path of a small but quite powerful wrecking ball that swings to within millimeters of his chin. He might be firing a rifle into two paint cans filled with water, or charging himself with 300,000 volts of electricity with a large contraption called a Van de Graaff generator, like something out of a mad scientist's laboratory in a science fiction movie, so that his already wild hair stands straight out from his skull. He uses his body as a piece of experimental equipment. As he says often, science requires sacrifices, after all. In one demonstration, captured in the photo on the jacket of this book, he sits on an extremely uncomfortable metal ball at the end of a rope suspended from the lecture hall ceiling, what he calls the mother of all pendulums, and swings back and forth while his students chant the number of swings, all to prove that the number of swings a pendulum makes in any given time is independent of the weight at its end. His son, Emmanuel, Chuck Lewin, has attended some of these lectures and recounts, "I saw him once inhale helium to change his voice. To get the effect right, the devil is in the details, he typically gets pretty close to the point of fading." An accomplished artist of the blackboard, Lewin draws geometrical figures, vectors, graphs, astronomical phenomena, and animals with abandon. His method of drawing dotted lines so entranced several students that they produced a funny YouTube video titled "Some of Walter Lewin's Best Lines," consisting simply of lecture excerpts showing Lewin drawing his famous dotted lines on different blackboards during his 8.01 lectures. A commanding, charismatic presence, Lewin is a genuine eccentric, quirky, and physics-obsessed. He carries two devices called polarizers in his wallet at all times, so that at a moment's notice, he can see if any source of light, such as the blue sky, a rainbow, or reflections off windows, is polarized, and whoever he might be with can see it too. What about those blue work shirts he wears to class? Not work shirts at all, it turns out. Lewin orders them custom-made to his specifications of high-grade cotton, a dozen at a time every few years, from a tailor in Hong Kong.
Lisa Genova has a Ph.D. in neuroscience from Harvard University. She is the author of the New York Times best-selling novels Still Alice and Left Neglected. Still Alice, her touching book about living with Alzheimer's, debuted at number 5 on the New York Times bestseller list and spent 36 weeks on that list. It's won numerous awards. There are over 1 million copies in print, and it's been translated into 25 languages. Left Neglected, about traumatic brain injury, spent 7 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list in hardcover. It was the number 1 indie pick for January 2011, the Borders book you'll love for January 2011, too. Lisa is currently writing her third novel, Love Anthony, about a boy with autism. She lives with her family on Cape Cod, and I spoke with her at the recent writers' conference there. Welcome, Lisa. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I understand that you first self-published your book, Still Alice. Tell us about its evolution to New York Times bestseller.
Well, I was a new writer, an unknown, and I did what all new writers do when they finish their manuscript. You send out query letters to literary agents who might represent your book to then go on and hopefully sell it to a publishing house who will then publish your book. But I didn't have any luck with the traditional route. I sent out about 100 query letters, and I'm still to this day, I unearthed 19 rejection letters the other day that I thought I had thrown them all out long ago. So I was really left with no choice. The choice was either to stick the manuscript in a drawer and go do something else, or to self-publish it and give it a shot. So I self-published it for 10 months and sold it out of the trunk of my car here on Cape Cod and did a lot of online marketing. I also hired a book publicity firm called Kelly and Hall Book Publicity out of Marblehead. And after 10 months, generated enough of a buzz and was introduced to a literary agent. And then the book sold at auction to Simon & Schuster.
Your focus was not on the caregivers, but on the patient. Tell us about that.
Well, this was really the reason why I wanted to write this story. I wasn't a novelist before I wrote Still Alice, and the seed for the story for me was watching my grandmother with Alzheimer's and not understanding what she was going through. I have a PhD in neuroscience, so I figured it was my job in the family to help learn as much as I could about Alzheimer's and pass that information along to my relatives so they could better take care of her. It was mostly my aunts who were doing the heavy lifting with the caregiving. And everything I read was written by a caregiver or a clinician or a scientist or a social worker. They were all views from the outside looking in. And so I could never get a real satisfying answer to the question, what does it feel like to have this? And so that's why I wanted to tell it from her point of view.
Your next project was Left Neglected. Talk about that.
So Left Neglected came out of a curiosity. I kept coming across little snippets, clinical vignettes over the years in my training as a neuroscientist about people with left neglect. It's this very strange neurological condition in which the brain no longer understands or pays attention to anything on the left side of anything, including the left side of you. So if you have this, you can still see, your eyes still work, your vision is intact, and you're not paralyzed. You could move your left arm and leg if only you knew that they belong to you. So it's this very bizarre condition, and I wanted to write about someone who has it because I just really wanted to understand what it's like to live in a whole world only aware of half of it. And I sort of thought of this condition the more I learned about it and the more people I came to know who have it, that it's really this, you know, here we have this very extreme inattention and it seems so bizarre and abnormal, but it really is this great metaphor for all the ways we every day ignore so many things and call it normal. You know, we're all so busy and multitasking and we're spread so thin. We're all doing five things at once. And when you spread your attention out that thin, your brain really can't handle that many things at once. What are you missing out on? What are you neglecting in your days?
The main character was a multitasking, high-powered woman executive. Was she a composite of people that you knew, or was there actually one person that you based her on?
Oh, she's definitely not based on one person. She is the me I could have been if I had stayed in corporate America. She's like a lot of working moms. I don't think that we working moms really have it figured out. I don't think we can have it all at once. So trying to, you know, go full throttle at work and then have three kids at home and, you know, maintain intimacy with your husband and maintain a household. And she's just, you know, really juggling way too many balls at once. And so I get her. I think a lot of women try to do too much at once.
Now, you're a Harvard scientist. And what advice would you have for someone of the sciences who wants to write a book that's accepted by the general public and not just a scientific journal?
Well, I mean, there's so many things. I mean, I didn't go to school for writing, so you have to, it's vastly different. Scientific writing is very dry and to the point, and there's not a lot of creative juiciness in there. The books I recommend, I was pointed to some really great books when I began. On Writing by Stephen King, Writing Down the Bones by Natalie Goldberg, and The Artist's Way by Julia Cameron are great places to get started.
We recently just previewed the Stephen King book. It's really such a different but inspiring work by him.
Absolutely, yeah.
Do you have a mission when you're writing your novels, or are you a storyteller?
I love this question. Primarily, I'm a storyteller to begin with, because if I don't entertain you, then you're not going to read the book. You're going to shut it and go on to read something else. So I really have to entertain you with a great story first. But you're right. The neuroscientist in me can't resist trying to teach the general public a little something about how the brain works and how it reveals aspects of who we are and our humanity. So I am trying to get a little education in there. And I like the idea of giving a voice to the voiceless or a face to someone who isn't well understood.
What is your next project that you're working on now?
The next book I'm writing is called Love, Anthony, and it's about a boy with autism.
Why that topic?
So this one is very dear and close to my heart. My closest cousin, who is like a sister to me, her son, who's the same age as my oldest daughter, has autism. And so this is something our family has been living with and struggling with and trying to understand.
With so much being written about traumatic brain injury with returning veterans and so on, have you been receiving feedback from veterans about your book?
Yeah, I have. And it's been incredibly rewarding to hear from not only veterans, but other people who have had traumatic brain injuries or injuries that sort of act like traumatic brain injuries. And one of the things that the book has done for people is to not only give them a sense of, again, a voice that that what they go through is something that others go through as well. So it's less isolating and alienating. But there's also this organization called New England Handicapped Sports, which is a real organization that I highlight in the book that gets people with these kinds of injuries and disabilities on the mountain or in kayaks in the summer. They get them moving again in ways that sort of seem impossible at first. And it's not just New England Handicapped Sports. They will write to me or write to this organization and then find a similar group that's near wherever they live in the country.
Are any of your projects being considered for movies or television?
So fun that you asked this. Yeah, we're moving ahead with a movie deal for Still Alice as we speak.
And will that be on the big screen or TV?
Big screen.
Big screen. Will you have any part of that, choosing a screenwriter, or will you be a part of that project?
I'm new to this process, and what I have told the producers is that I am here to facilitate and not get in the way.
I think that's sage advice after speaking with screenwriter Diane Lake today. Yes. Are you still doing scientific research, or are you spending all your time writing these days?
I'm a full-time novelist and mother, and that's about all I can handle.
And how much of your time is taken up by promotion and book tours? I know marketing the book is so much a part of an author's life these days. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, it's definitely challenging, and I'm learning a lot as I go. In the first 2 to 3 months after the book is released, it's pretty intense in terms of travel and book events, at least for me. And then it can slow down, and you can pick and choose. I also work with a speakers bureau because I write about things like Alzheimer's and traumatic brain injuries. I have opportunities to talk to groups about this. So I do travel a bit and speak to organizations like the Alzheimer's Association. Again, it's sort of, you know, you learn as you go. And this summer, the trade paperback of Left Neglected came out in July. And I said, I live on Cape Cod. I'm not getting on a plane. Everybody's here. So my book events this summer have been local, which is nice.
What tips do you have for writers who have that first novel in their drawer and are wanting to get it out there?
Well, you know, I'd say that self-publishing is a route to consider. I think years ago, it certainly carried a very large stigma, and it still does. And I understand why. I mean, there are no gatekeepers for self-publishing, so anyone can publish anything. But it can be a legitimate road to market these days, sort of like we've seen with independent filmmakers and musicians who can put out their own record through CD Baby and you know, gather fans. You can gather fans through self-publishing and sort of demonstrate a proof of concept to publishers. Like, look, I've got an audience, an enthusiastic readership.
Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed reading your book, and I encourage anyone to pick it up. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Still Alice is my guest Lisa Genova's heart-wrenching tale of 50-year-old Alice Howland and her early-onset Alzheimer diagnosis. Alice was a successful linguistics professor at Harvard. Her husband, John, was an equally esteemed Harvard professor. Together, they had 3 grown children and a very fulfilling life, until Alice started to forget things. It began innocuously enough, misplacing her BlackBerry, missing unimportant appointments on her to-do list, searching her mind for tip-of-the-tongue phrases. But when she went on her familiar daily run through Cambridge and became disoriented 1 mile from home, Alice knew something was terribly wrong. A battery of tests and multiple doctor visits later, her worst nightmare was confirmed. She was in the first stages of early onset Alzheimer's disease. Told from Alice's perspective, this title is a keen insight to the slow deterioration of a debilitating disease. Every nuance of pain, frustration, fear, and sorrow is captured to convey the confusion and pain of Howland's thoughts. This is an extraordinary debut novel read by the author. Let's listen.
He grabbed them like a relay runner taking a baton in a race and headed for the front door. "Will you be here when I get home on Saturday?" she asked his back as she followed him down the hallway. I don't know. I've got a huge day in lab on Saturday. He collected his briefcase, phone, and keys from the hall table. Have a good trip. Give Lydia a hug and kiss for me, and try not to battle with her, said John. She caught their reflection in the hallway mirror. A distinguished-looking tall man with white-flecked brown hair and glasses, a petite, curly-haired woman, her arms crossed over her chest, each readying to leap into that same bottomless argument. She gritted her teeth and swallowed, choosing not to jump. "We haven't seen each other in a while. Please try to be home," she asked. "I know. I'll try." He kissed her, and although desperate to leave, he lingered in that kiss for an almost imperceptible moment. If she didn't know him better, she might have romanticized his kiss. She might have stood there, hopeful, thinking it said, "I love you, I'll miss you." But as she watched him hustle down the street alone, she felt pretty certain he'd just told her, "I love you, but please don't be pissed when I'm not home on Saturday." They used to walk together over to Harvard Yard every morning. Of the many things she loved about working within a mile from home and at the same school, their shared commute was the thing she loved most. They always stopped at Jerry's, a black coffee for him, a tea with lemon for her, iced or hot depending on the season, and continued on to Harvard Yard, chatting about their research and classes, issues in their respective departments, their children, or plans for that evening. When they were first married, they even held hands. She savored the relaxed intimacy of these morning walks with him before the daily demands of their jobs and ambitions rendered them each stressed and exhausted. But for some time now, they'd been walking over to Harvard separately. Alice had been living out of her suitcase all summer, attending psychology conferences in Rome, New Orleans, and Miami, and serving on an exam committee for a thesis defense at Princeton. Back in the spring, John's cell cultures had needed some sort of rinsing attention at an obscene hour each morning, but he didn't trust any of his students to show up consistently, so he did. She couldn't remember the reasons that predated spring, but she knew that each time they'd seemed reasonable and only temporary. She returned to the paper at her desk, still distracted, now by a craving for that fight she hadn't had with John about their younger daughter, Lydia. Would it kill him to stand behind her for once? She gave the rest of the paper a cursory effort, not her typical standard of excellence, but it would have to do, given her fragmented state of mind and lack of time. Her comments and suggestions for revision finished, she packaged and sealed the envelope, guiltily aware that she might have missed an error in the study's design or interpretation, cursing John for compromising the integrity of her work. She repacked her suitcase, not even emptied yet from her last trip. She looked forward to traveling less in the coming months. There were only a handful of invited lectures penciled in her fall semester calendar, and she'd scheduled most of those on Fridays, a day she didn't teach. Like tomorrow. Tomorrow she would be the guest speaker to kick off Stanford's Cognitive Psychology Fall Colloquium Series. And afterward she'd see Lydia. She'd try not to battle with her, but she wasn't making any promises. Alice found her way easily to Stanford's Cordura Hall on the corner of Campus Drive West and Panama Drive. Its white stucco exterior, terracotta roof, and lush landscaping looked to her East Coast eyes more like a Caribbean beach resort than an academic building. She arrived quite early, but ventured inside anyway, figuring she could use the extra time to sit in the quiet auditorium and look over her talk. Much to her surprise, she walked into an already packed room. A zealous crowd surrounded and circled a buffet table, aggressively diving in for food like seagulls at a city beach. Before she could sneak in unnoticed, she noticed Josh, a former Harvard classmate and respected egomaniac, standing in her path, his legs planted firmly and a little too wide, as if he was ready to dive at her. "All this for me?" asked Alice, smiling playfully.
Although Although this title has been out for a few years, I include it here for several reasons. His Brother's Keeper, A Story from the Edge of Medicine by Pulitzer Prize winner Jonathan Weiner, has won multiple awards when it was published. It chronicles one family's deeply human, defiant response to the horrifying prognosis of ALS. I chose this title because, tragically, my own cherished sister has this terrible disease. Jamie, Stephen, and Ben are the Haywood brothers, adoring daredevil sons of a retired therapist and MIT professor. At 29, Stephen, a carpenter, is diagnosed with amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease, a progressive fatal condition that bombs nerve cells in the brain and spinal cord, collapsing voluntary muscle control and making it hard to chew, swallow, speak, and finally to breathe. Almost overnight, older brother Jamie, who had been a mechanical engineer, turned himself into a genetic engineer in the race to cure the incurable. This is a powerful account of their story as they travel together to the edge of medicine, investigating gene therapy, stem cells, brain vaccines, and other novel treatments for nerve death diseases like ALS, Alzheimer's, and Parkinson's, diseases that afflict millions and touch the lives of many more. The title is poignantly narrated by Victor Bevine.
When they were boys, Jamie and Stephen Haywood loved to arm wrestle. They made it a ritual. First the right arm, then the left, then, if there was time, a wrestling match on the rug. Their rules of engagement were so complicated and so long unspoken that no one else ever learned the game. Even Jamie's best friend, Duncan Moss, did not know how to play. Duncan would take one step across the line on the rug. Then he would see the look on Jamie's face. What? What did I do? He did not know the rules. The Haywoods lived in an old house on Mill Street in Newtonville, Massachusetts, a suburb of Boston. All three of the Haywood boys, Jamie, then Stephen, and then the youngest, Ben, were athletic dreamers, inventors of many rituals and adventures. The house on Mill Street is a block from a patch of woods and a pond. The brothers played football there in a corner field by the house of a neighbor they called Aunt Betsy. Late at night, when it rained hard, Jamie and Stephen snuck out with boogie boards. They hopped a fence to the creek, which got roaring in a good storm. Through the dark and the rain, they rode the rapids out of Bulow's Pond. Their parents, Peggy and John Haywood, are well known in Newtonville. They love traditions, too. Each of them has served terms as senior warden of Grace Church in Newton Corner. When their boys were young, they went back every summer to the dairy farm in South Dakota where Peggy had grown up. She had won a full scholarship to Radcliffe in Cambridge, which is where she met John. Peggy worked as a therapist. She kept her practice small and devoted herself to the family. Every 7 years, they spent a year in England, where John was born and raised. John Haywood is a professor of mechanical engineering at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and an international authority on internal combustion engines. He is the son of a British coal engineer who turned to solar power early on, back when only the cranks were interested in what he had to say, back when a maverick who worried about coal smoke, soot, and acid, and praised the power of the sun, was like a bolt from the future. John Haywood consults about energy efficiency for Ford in Detroit, Ferrari in Italy, Toyota in Japan. When he is at home, he runs MIT's Sloan Automotive Laboratory, to which he commutes from Mill Street on a bicycle. Each summer in July or August, Peggy's side of the family gathered from across the country for a reunion at the beach town of Duck, near Kitty Hawk, in the Outer Banks of North Carolina. A few of the children on the beach were always honorary Haywoods, as Aunt Betsy was an honorary aunt. John and Peggy, Jamie, Stephen, and Ben each brought friends. The boys swam, sailed, surfed, and raced on the cold, shining track the waves made for them. Every summer on one of their last days at Duck, they played a game of basketball at the beach, wickedly violent games that routinely sent one of their cousins to the hospital. As Jamie and Stephen got older, they kept arm wrestling ritually. In their late teens and early 20s, when the 2.5 years between them no longer mattered, they were perfectly matched. But Jamie became a mechanical engineer, like their father and his father in England. Jamie was intelligent and driven, and spent his days and nights working at a desk. Stephen became a carpenter, a hands-on man like their mother's father and brother in South Dakota. Stephen was intelligent, too, but he mistrusted desks and ambitions. He spent a few years swinging a hammer on a framing crew, and his right arm became unbeatable. Late in July of 1997, when Jamie was 30 and Stephen was 28, they arm wrestled in the beach house their parents had rented that summer at Duck. Jamie was 5'11" and 3/4 inches tall, and he weighed 165 pounds. Stephen was 6'3", 220. Jamie was keeping himself in shape, but Stephen was building his first house that year, and his right bicep and tricep were very well defined. In arm wrestling, there is always a moment when the winner knows he has won and the loser knows he has lost. The brothers were both surprised when they realized that for the first time in 5 years, Jamie would force Stephen's right arm down to the table. Jamie whooped, "I beat my carpenter brother! I'm the man! I'm the man!" Stephen won the next bout, which they fought, as always, left-handed. That shut up Jamie. Neither of them suspected that anything was wrong.
The Psychopath Test by John Ronson is a fascinating journey through the minds of madness. When I saw the author on Jon Stewart, I knew I wanted to preview this title. An influential psychologist who was convinced that many CEOs and politicians are, in fact, psychopaths, taught Ronson how to spot these high-flying individuals by looking out for little telltale verbal and nonverbal clues. And so Ronson, armed with his new psychopath spotting abilities, entered the corridors of power. He spends time with a legendary CEO whose psychopathy has been speculated about in the press, and a patient in an asylum for the criminally insane who insists he's sane. Ronson discovered that sometimes the personalities at the helm of the madness industry are, with their drives and obsessions, as mad in their own way as those they study. And that relatively ordinary people are, more and more, defined by their maddest edges. The author narrates.
Maybe, suggested one recipient, the book should be read as a Christian allegory. Even from the enigmatic, "We'll tell you more when I return," clearly a reference to the second coming of Jesus. The authors seem to be contradicting Sartre's atheist being and nothingness, not B or N. A researcher in perceptual psychology called Sarah Alred agreed. I have a vague suspicion this is going to end up being some viral marketing, advertising ploy by some sort of religious organisation in which academics, intellectuals, scientists, philosophers will come off looking foolish. To others, this seemed unlikely. The expensiveness factor rules out the viral theory unless the campaign is counting on the carefully selected targets to ponder about the mysterious book online. Most of the recipients believed the answer lay, intriguingly, with them. They had been hand-picked to receive the package. There was clearly a pattern at work. But what was it? Had they all attended the same conference together years ago or something? Maybe they were being headhunted for a top position in some secretive business. "First one to crack the code gets the job, so to speak," wrote one Australian recipient. What seemed obvious was that a brilliant person or organisation with ties to Gothenburg had devised a puzzle so complex that even clever academics like them couldn't decipher it. Perhaps it couldn't be decoded because the code was incomplete. Maybe there was a missing piece. Someone suggested holding the letter closely over a lamp or try the iodine vapour test on it. There may be some secret writing on it in another type of ink. But there didn't turn out to be any secret writing. They threw up their hands in defeat. If this was a puzzle that academics couldn't solve, maybe they should bring in someone more brutish, like a private investigator or a journalist. Deborah asked around, which reporter might be tenacious and intrigued enough to engage with the mystery? They went through a few names. And then Deborah's friend James said, "What about John Ronson?" On the day I received Deborah's email inviting me to the Costa Coffee, I was in the midst of quite a bad anxiety attack. I'd been interviewing a man named Dave McKay. He was the charismatic leader of a small Australian religious group called the Jesus Christians, and had recently suggested to his members that they each donate their spare kidney to a stranger. Dave and I had got on pretty well at first. He'd seemed engagingly eccentric, and I was consequently gathering good material for my story, enjoyably nutty quotes from him, etc. But when I proposed that group pressure emanating from Dave was perhaps the reason why some of his more vulnerable members might be choosing to give up a kidney, he exploded. He sent me a message saying that to teach me a lesson, he was putting the brakes on an imminent kidney donation. He would let the recipient die, and her death would be on my conscience.
An unborn baby with a fatal heart defect, a skier submerged for an hour in a frozen Norwegian lake, a comatose brain surgery patient whom doctors declared a vegetable. 20 years ago, all of them would have been given up for dead. But today, thanks to incredible medical advances, these folks are alive and well. In his riveting book, Cheating Death, The Doctors and Medical Miracles That Are Saving Lives Against All Odds, by Dr. Sanjay Gupta, neurosurgeon, chief medical correspondent for CNN, and best-selling author, chronicles the almost unbelievable science that has made these seemingly miraculous recoveries possible. A bold new breed of doctors achieved amazing rescues by refusing to accept that any life is lost. Today's revolutionary advances are blurring the traditional line between life and death in fascinating ways. Drawing on real-life stories and new medical research, Dr. Gupta, who narrates, presents dramatic accounts of how pioneering physicians and researchers are changing medicine.
We're used to thinking about dying in stark terms, dead or alive. You're here, and then you're gone. In our imagination, this is how the moment of death plays out. The villain or hero or soldier, gasping last words, stretching out a hand, until his eyes roll back in his head, and we know it's all over. Or the cancer patient surrounded by family. A light flickers behind her eyes, and then goes out. You've read it in 1,000 stories, seen it in 1,000 movies. 100 episodes of ER. The alarm sounds, the monitor flatlines. Time of death, 2:15 a.m. It only takes a few minutes for life to slip away. Without a heartbeat, circulation slows to a halt. Blood no longer flows to your brain or any other organ. It takes just a couple of minutes before everything goes dim, and you're blissfully unaware of the catastrophe unfolding inside your body. Starved of blood, the first organ to suffer is the brain, which in happier times consumes about 20% of all oxygen the body takes in, though it constitutes just 2% of our body mass. After 10 seconds without oxygen, the brain's function slows. Without oxygen or signals from the brain, other organs break down as well. Diaphragm muscles no longer contract and release to bring in air. The kidneys stop filtering blood. At the same time, an elaborate chain of chemical reactions trigger a breakdown in cells throughout the body. This is the process of dying. Whether because of a car accident, a blockage in an artery, or a tumor somewhere in your body, it is generally understood that when the heart stops beating, life is ended. I have seen this play out more times than I care to remember. The first time, I was a third-year medical student at the University of Michigan. The patient was not much older than I was. I remember the call coming over the emergency radio. 23-year-old unrestrained driver in an MVA. Motor vehicle accident. Found with the windshield starred and steering wheel bent. Even then, I knew those details were important. It takes a lot of force to bend a steering wheel with your chest or smash a windshield with your head. I remember the trauma surgeons, neurosurgeons, and orthopedic surgeons descending on this young man. They attempted to replace blood, stop bleeding, and relieve pressure in his brain. It was a whirlwind of activity until his heart stopped, and then everything else stopped too. Everyone knew that was the end. After all, that's what we were taught in medical school and throughout our training. But what if it doesn't have to be that way? What if there are a way to give that 23-year-old man and millions like him just a little more time to shift the line between life and death? Ever since I watched that young man die, I have pondered that very question. Can we move the line? Surrounded by friends and family in his Bronx apartment, Zayad Barazanji told me his story of cheating death in a warm, friendly way. Barazanji, a translator and retired Columbia professor, immigrated here from Syria back in the 1970s. His two-bedroom apartment was filled with artwork and mementos from a lifetime of traveling between New York and the Middle East. A delicious smell was in the air. His wife Rawa was whipping up a feast of Syrian delicacies, and dinner was almost ready. I leaned in to listen over the buzz of activity and clinking glasses in the kitchen. We were interrupted more than once as Barazanji got up to answer the door, clapping friends on the back and hanging their coats. It was hard to believe that this man, so full of life, was dead not long ago. But that's exactly what happened. His heart pumped no blood, his brain sent no signals, he thought no thoughts. Make no mistake, this is death, but maybe not the way we tend to think about it. For all that's been said about immediate death, I'm sorry, she was killed instantly. In truth, there's no such thing. As a doctor, I can assure you that when the heart stops beating, it's not the end. Death is not a single event, but a process that may be interrupted, even reversed. And here's the exciting part. At any point during this process, the course of what seems inevitable can be changed. That is precisely what we're going to explore in this audiobook, the possibility of cheating death. As the ambulance screeched away from the curb in front of Bally's Total Fitness, Barazanji was in the gray zone. Not dead, but not quite fully alive either. Millions of cells in his heart were already dead, suffocated by a lack of blood flow.
Splendid Solution, Jonas Salk and the Conquest of Polio by Jeffrey Kluger is the riveting story of one of the greatest scientific accomplishments of the 20th century, from the co-author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Apollo 13. With rivalries, reversals, and a race against time, the struggle to eradicate polio is one of the great tales of modern history. It begins with the birth of Jonas Salk, shortly before one of the worst polio epidemics in U.S. history. At the time, the disease was a terrifying enigma. Striking from out of nowhere, it afflicted tens of thousands of children in this country each year and left them, literally overnight, paralyzed and sometimes at death's door. Salk was in medical school just as President Roosevelt was crippled by the disease. He provided the impetus for the drive to study polio. By the early 1950s, Salk had already helped create an influenza vaccine and was hot on the trail of the polio virus. He was nearly thwarted, though, by the politics of medicine and by a rival researcher eager to discredit his solution. Meanwhile, in 1952, polio was spreading in record numbers, with 57,000 cases in the U.S. that summer alone. In early 1954, Salk was weighing the possibility of trials of a not-yet-perfected vaccine against, as the summer approached, the prospect of thousands more children being struck down by the disease. The results of the history-making trials were announced at a press conference on April 12, 1955. The vaccine works. The room and an entire nation erupted in cheers for this singular medical achievement. Salk became a cultural hero and an icon for a whole generation. Michael Pritchard narrates this important chronicle of Salk's life and work.
All the talk about the little white coffins seemed to start out of nowhere. But when it did, the word spread fast. Tens of thousands of them were out there, it was said, stashed in depots around the country. The location of the depots was never specified, and that was just as well. If you knew where the caches of coffins were kept, you'd know where the government expected the people to start dying. All of those people would be children, of course. That's why the coffins were little and white. Jonas Salk, it was said, would be the person responsible for the deaths. It was Salk who had cultured up the virus that would be injected into the boys and girls. Salk himself was certain this version of the preparation would not do anyone any harm. The virus he was using was dead, after all. He had killed it himself. Months before, Salk and his colleagues had tried his formula out on monkeys, and the results had been good. Only then had he injected himself and his lab workers, not to mention his wife and his three young sons. The oldest of the boys barely 10, the youngest barely 4. And only after inoculating all of them had he similarly treated the 7,500 children whose parents had willingly, indeed desperately, offered them up. In just a few more weeks, 400,000 other children around the country would be lining up to receive SOX injections, too. It was perhaps the greatest experiment of its kind ever attempted by medical science. Salk tried not to be troubled by the coffin story as it got around, but it wasn't easy. It wasn't his injections that were dangerous, after all. It was a wild virus, a virus that had killed uncounted children for generations and had been attacking with a special savageness in the past few years. In the summer of 1952 alone, more than 55,000 children in the United States had gone to bed with what their mothers believed was a cold, and had woken up feverish, chilled, and rubber-limbed the next day. When the worried-looking doctor was led into the children's rooms, where they lay flat on their clammy backs beneath their wilted sheets, he'd ask them almost casually if they wouldn't mind lifting up their heads to look at their belly buttons. When they couldn't, it was as sure a sign as any that the cold was actually poliomyelitis, and that the queerly rubbery limbs would soon grow much worse. The following summer, over 35,000 more children went to bed sick and failed the belly button test, and were hurried off to hospitals, where they waited to learn if the virus would quit when it had claimed their legs, or if it would go after their arms and their torsos, and their very breath as well. Now it was April 1954, and the fast warming spring weather was as sure a reminder as any that the polio season was again approaching, following the heat from south to north, picking off children as it went like shot hitting skeet. It was against that onrushing danger that Salk had been racing. And it was against that same danger that all the whispering about the coffins got started. It was whispering that was begun, not surprisingly, by Walter Winchell. During the Second World War, Winchell had been one of the glitteriest, if most rough-cut stones in Hollywood's jewel box of celebrity reporters. In recent years, however, the appeal of his Carnival Barker reporting had faded. And while plenty of newspapers still carried his column, his true soapbox was now radio, where he'd shout out his stories in a 15-minute slot every Sunday night.
Those of you who try but can't always avoid grabbing handrails on subways and buses may be relieved to know that elements used by many transportation systems, like copper and silver, are naturally antibacterial. The structure and composition of the metal is somehow able to inactivate the bacteria, making it an ideal surface for things like subway handrails. This is the type of instantly lovable, immediately gratifying knowledge you get from Sam Keen's The Disappearing Spoon and other true tales of madness, love, and the history of the world from the periodic table of elements. This is a fascinating column-by-column, row-by-row dissection of the periodic table. Keen turns what could have been boring historical and scientific accounts into bite-sized human dramas filled with humorous moments and ironic twists. The predictable accounts of science heroes like Marie Curie and Dmitry Mendeleev are given fresh new spins, while the tales of lesser-known scientists are told with gusto. The remarkably intriguing narration by Sean Runette is the icing on the cake in this title, so let's listen.
For a long time, I kept an eye out for Element 80 at school and in books, as you might watch for a childhood friend's name in the newspaper. I'm from the Great Plains and had learned in history class that Lewis and Clark had trekked through South Dakota and the rest of the Louisiana Territory with a microscope, compasses, sextant, three mercury thermometers, and other instruments. What I didn't know at first is that they also carried with them 600 mercury laxatives, each 4 times the size of an aspirin. The laxatives were called Dr. Rush's bilious pills, after Benjamin Rush, a signer of the Declaration of Independence and a medical hero for bravely staying in Philadelphia during a yellow fever epidemic in 1793. His pet treatment for any disease was a mercury chloride sludge administered orally. Despite the progress medicine made overall between 1400 and 1800, doctors in that era remained closer to medicine men than medical men. With a sort of sympathetic magic, they figured that beautiful, alluring mercury could cure patients by bringing them to an ugly crisis, poison fighting poison. Dr. Rush made patients ingest the solution until they drooled, and often people's teeth and hair fell out after weeks or months of continuous treatment. His cure no doubt poisoned or outright killed swaths of people whom yellow fever might have spared. Even so, having perfected his treatment in Philadelphia, 10 years later he sent Meriwether and William off with some prepackaged samples. As a handy side effect, Dr. Rush's pills have enabled modern archaeologists to track down campsites used by the explorers. With the weird food and questionable water they encountered in the wild, someone in their party was always queasy, and to this day mercury deposits dot the soil many places where the gang dug a latrine, perhaps after one of Dr. Rush's thunderclappers had worked a little too well. Mercury also came up in science class. When first presented with the jumble of the periodic table, I scanned for mercury and couldn't find it. It is there, between gold, which is also dense and soft, and thallium, which is also poisonous. But the symbol for mercury, HG, consists of 2 letters that don't even appear in its name. Unraveling that mystery, it's from hydrogerum, Latin for water silver, helped me understand how heavily ancient languages and mythology influenced the periodic table, something you can still see in the Latin names for the newer, super-heavy elements along the bottom row. I found mercury in literature class as well. Hat manufacturers once used a bright orange mercury wash to separate fur from pelts, and the common hatters who dredged around in the steamy vats, like the Mad One in Alice in Wonderland, gradually lost their hair and wits. Eventually, I realized how poisonous mercury is. That explained why Dr. Rush's bilious pills purged the bowels so well. The body will rid itself of any poison, mercury included. And as toxic as swallowing mercury is, its fumes are worse. They fray the wires in the central nervous system and burn holes in the brain, much as advanced Alzheimer's disease does. But the more I learned about the dangers of mercury, the more, like William Blake's Tiger, Tiger, Burning Bright, its destructive beauty attracted me. Over the years, my parents redecorated their kitchen and took down the shelf with the mug and teddy bear. But they kept the knick-knacks together in a cardboard box. On a recent visit, I dug out the green-labeled bottle and opened it. Tilting it back and forth, I could feel the weight inside, sliding in a circle. When I peeked over the rim, my eyes fixed on the tiny bits that had splashed to the sides of the main channel. They just sat there, glistening, like beads of water so perfect you'd encounter them only in fantasies. All throughout my childhood, I associated spilled mercury with a fever. This time, knowing the fearful symmetry of those little spheres, I felt a chill. From that one element, I learned history, etymology, alchemy, mythology, literature, poison forensics, and psychology. And those weren't the only elemental stories I collected, especially after I immersed myself in scientific studies in college and found a few professors who gladly set aside their research for a little science chit-chat.
Anyone searching for a laugh-out-loud science selection should look no farther than Mary Roach's Packing for Mars, The Curious Science of Life in the Void. Those who've enjoyed Roach's previous books, Stiff, Spook, and Bonk, will not be disappointed by this latest offering, a look at the quirky realities of space travel usually left out of NASA press releases. Space is a world devoid of the things we need to live and thrive: air, gravity, hot showers, fresh produce, privacy, and beer. Space exploration is in some ways an exploration of what it means to be human. How much can a person give up? How much weirdness can they take? What happens to you when you can't walk for a year, have sex, smell flowers? Is it possible for the human body to survive a bailout at 17,000 miles per hour? Weightless flight regurgitation phenomenon is discussed in detail, as is the TMI quality of the Soviets' restricted hygiene experiments. And did you know that rabbit and guinea pigs are the only mammals not to suffer from motion sickness? Wonderfully performed by Sandra Burr, you'll be treated to the humorous, sometimes snarky, but always fascinating bits of info. From space euphoria to the space stupids, Packing for Mars lets you preview space without ever leaving Earth.
To the rocket scientist, you are a problem. You're the most irritating piece of machinery he or she will ever have to deal with. You and your fluctuating metabolism, your puny memory, your frame that comes in a million different configurations. You're unpredictable. You're inconstant. You take weeks to fix. The engineer must worry about the water and oxygen and food you'll need in space, about how much extra fuel it will take to launch your shrimp cocktail and irradiated beef tacos. A solar cell or a thruster nozzle is stable and undemanding. It does not excrete or panic or fall in love with the mission commander. It has no ego. Its structural elements don't start to break down without gravity, and it works just fine without sleep. To me, you are the best thing to happen to rocket science. The human being is the machine that makes the whole endeavor so endlessly intriguing. To take an organism whose every feature has evolved to keep it alive and thriving in a world with oxygen, gravity, and water, to suspend that organism in the wasteland of space for a month or a year, is a preposterous but captivating undertaking. Everything one takes for granted on Earth must be rethought, relearned, rehearsed. Full-grown men and women, toilet-trained, a chimpanzee dressed in a flight suit and launched into orbit. An entire odd universe of mock outer space has grown up here on Earth. Capsules that never blast off, hospital wards where healthy people spend months on their backs masquerading zero gravity, crash labs where cadavers drop to Earth in simulated splashdowns. A couple years back, a friend at NASA had been working on something over in Building 9 at the Johnson Space Center. This is the building with the mock-ups, some 50 in all, modules, airlocks, hatches, capsules. For days, Renee had been hearing an intermittent squeaking racket. Finally, he went to investigate. Some poor guy in a space suit running on a treadmill suspended from a big, complicated gizmo to simulate Martian gravity. Lots of clipboards and timers and radio headsets and concerned looks all around. It occurred to me, reading his email, that it's possible in a way to visit space without leaving Earth, or anyway, a sort of slapstick, surreal make-believe edition, which is more or less where I've been these past 2 years. Of the millions of pages of documents and reports generated by the first moon landing, none is more telling, to me anyway, than an 11-page paper presented at the 26th annual meeting of the North American Vexillological Association. Vexillology is the study of flags, not the study of vexing things. But in this case, either would fit.
Readers, I hope you'll agree that our scientific exploration has been interesting and fun. When you're searching the universe for new titles, look no further than my website, bookreportradio.com. You'll find so many books there worthy of your exploration and your time. Thanks so much for joining us today, and see you next week on The Book Report. You slip across with me.